I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, we're going to have a conversation with small business owners from the Gulf, making the case for lifting that ban on deepwater offshore drilling. In one case, a company says America's pension plans are tied to his company's success. We'll have that story. But first, an update on all the activity in Washington today. President Obama is preparing his Oval Office address scheduled for tonight. And top oil company executives are testifying before Congress. Committee Chair and California Democrat Henry Waxman saying BP failed miserably in responding to the well blowout, but he also said he doubted any other oil company would have done better because of what he called cookie-cutter emergency response plans. And Republican Congressman from Florida, Cliff Stearns, had this question for oil company executives.
So the question is, can each one of you in your heart of hearts say to us that America is protected with all the oil rigs you have out there? We have almost 3,800 in the Gulf. Can you tell us today that we'll be safe?
Other oil companies have been distancing themselves from BP today. Rex Tillerson is the CEO of Exxon. He told lawmakers that the blowout wouldn't have happened if BP had properly designed its well and followed procedures.
Based on the industry's extensive experience, what we do know is when you properly design wells for the range of risk anticipated, follow established procedures, build in layers of redundancy, properly inspect and maintain equipment, train operators, conduct tests and drills, and focus on safe operations and risk management, tragic incidents like the one we are witnessing in the Gulf of Mexico today should not occur.
And here's Massachusetts Democrat Ed Markey questioning Lamar McKay, the chair of BP America, and lambasting BP for underestimating the amount of oil that would gush from the blown-out well, and also repeatedly asking McKay to apologize.
Please, one final chance. Apologize for getting that number wrong.
We are sorry for everything the Gulf Coast is going through. We are sorry for that and the spill. What I can say is we have provided every bit of data and information we have to the Unified Command, to the government, to every scientist that's working on this full-time and from that day you're talking about. So we do not have the technology to measure that. That is still under evaluation.
I continue to believe that BP is still more interested in its liability than it is in the livability of the Gulf, and this hearing is just one further indication of that.
A taste of the hearings today as five big oil companies go before Congress. Gail Chadwick is Capitol Hill correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Gail, what is jumping out at you?
This is not your average congressional oversight hearing. The Democrats have been preparing for this for at least 12 years, especially during the years of the Bush administration when oil really ran Capitol Hill. And there is no better interrogator and investigator than Henry Waxman. So I think what you saw today was the opening salvo of probably the most serious and intense hearings Congress will do this year.
Now, Democrats well prepared and some partisanship there in that Democrats using the hearings to push for a bigger climate bill, better energy legislation. Republicans also in the position of supporting continued offshore oil and gas drilling. Here's Texas Congressman Joe Barton talking about how the government should work with the oil companies.
But when you take a patient to the emergency room, the solution is not normally to kill the patient. The solution is to stabilize the patient, determine what needs to be done to save the patient, and then implement that strategy. And I will stipulate, Mr. Chairman, America needs the energy beneath the outer continental shelf off the coast of the United States of America. And the five men before us who represent five of the largest privately owned oil companies in the world, while they are part of the problem, they are a big part of the solution.
Gail Chadwick, again, you know, we're talking about some of the politics of the hearing today. I think most Americans want to know, you know, how you're going to fix it, and we'll hear about some of that as well. But staying with the politics, Republicans have been critical of the federal response. You say this is a signature moment for California Democrat Henry Waxman and Democrats who have been preparing for 12 years for this. But polls show, 52% of Americans disapprove of Obama's oil spill handling. So, how is this playing out?
Oh, this is a very big moment for him, the president, as well. As the hearings were going on, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republican leader, was on the floor saying it appears that the administration is more interested in scapegoats, finding scapegoats, than in solving the problem. And if you look at what Joe Barton said in his questioning, he asked BP, has the federal government suggested that you do anything that you said no to? To which they said, no, I don't believe so. And so what Republicans are going to try to do is to turn the issue on the White House. Where were you? Why did it take you so long to get engaged? Why did you accept the assurances from BP that they were prepared for the worst possible case when clearly they weren't? So it's becoming as much an indictment of the White House, a la Katrina, as it is of BP, or at least that's where the Republicans want to take it. And the only other thing I would say about that is it's not breaking on partisan lines. There are Democrats from Gulf areas dependent on offshore drilling that are also making the point that that moratorium on offshore drilling is clobbering jobs in a region that's already suffering from this spill. So I think when you see this issue especially come to the floor for votes, it's not going to be straight party line. Energy has always been a regional issue in this country, and that's going to show up as well.
Well, we'll hear a little more about that, but just as to the political back and forth, one wonders if the Republicans keep attacking the president's response, that doesn't open the door to, as you say, looking at the past 12 years of the system and the way it got set up. But just briefly, Gail, and very, very briefly, the president is expected to ask BP to set up this account. I know we heard today from BP, did they say they would set up this escrow account to pay out claims? Very briefly.
They did not. Their language has been very specific, that we are going to meet all lawful liabilities, but the 1990 law limits liabilities to $75 million unless in cases of negligence or willful misconduct, and that's what the Democrats are going at in these hearings.
Gail Chadwick, Capitol Hill correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Thanks, as always.
You're welcome.
And as we mentioned, the president is expected to lay out details of an agreement with BP to set up an independent multi-billion-dollar compensation fund to be independently put forth. And so far, BP says 42,000 people and businesses have filed claims directly to them. They've paid 20,000 of those claims, totaling about $53 million. But some businesses in the Gulf say the process has been a bureaucratic nightmare, and they're still waiting for cash. Matt Shipp owns Shipp's Harbor Grill in Orange Beach, Alabama. He says he's lost $57,000 because of the oil disaster. So, Matt, we know you're still open. So how are you losing money?
Because we are a tourist-based restaurant. We are located on the water in Orange Beach. It's a beautiful area. But because of the BP spill, they have basically shut down all recreational boating. They have shut down the beaches. You can't swim in the water. So there's tremendous cancellations, and the tourists has dropped tremendously.
And you are seeing, what, some tarballs there on shore?
Yeah, there's small tarballs on shore. You know, it comes in waves. One day it's really bad, one day it's not at all. But, you know, it's enough that they have closed the waters and put swimming advisories, half the reason you come to the beach.
Well, and I can't imagine, you are a restaurant, and we're hearing that these tarballs smell.
They do, and we are located on a marina. And so a lot of times you'll look out the marina and you don't see the pristine water that we're used to.
Well, now, you've tried to get claims from BP. What's been your experience?
Extremely difficult. We were actually the first to file a claim April 30th in Orange Beach, and we have received a compensation of $5,000 to date.
Well, tell me more about the claim.
Well, the claim was based upon lost revenues minus cost of goods sold, which was, you know, gross profits, and that's where we need to be. All our other expenses we're pretty much maintained. We've tried to maintain our labor. We've tried to maintain everything else.
But you claimed $35,000 in lost business, we understood?
In the first month, in May alone, $35,000 in losses directly due to the loss of revenue.
So then take me through the process with BP. You file, then what happened?
We filed. We're actually on our fourth adjuster. We've been passed around like a hot potato, we call it, because nobody wants our claim. Each adjuster has asked for more specific information. The most recent adjuster has asked for such detailed tax records and accounting records that it's almost impossible to supply for a small business. We don't maintain a full-time accounting firm. We're a small husband and wife, family-run business. You know, we do about $2.5 million a year in revenues. What they're asking for is extremely timely and difficult to get to them.
So after 40 days, we understand, of this, as you said, a lot of being bounced around, phone calls, faxes, $35,000 in the claim, what did you get?
I've received $5,000.
$5,000.
Now, I have been told last week that my claim had been approved for $18,000, but we are still waiting to receive those funds. We have not received them. Daily calls to find out where they're at. They don't know where they're at. Been told we don't know where they're coming from. We believe they're in the mail. I do have more meetings later this week for them to explain why there's a difference between the $35,000 that I claim and the $18,000 that they're giving me, or supposedly giving me.
Yeah. So meanwhile, a pretty big restaurant, it seats 250 people. So
yeah.
Every day that you don't serve, that's a lot of empty seats. Have you had to lay off people yet?
We've laid off several kitchen people. We've cut back a tremendous amount of hours on my kitchen staff. The service staff, we've laid off, you know, probably 25% of those service staff, plus cutting their hours as well. The problem is, being so seasonal, all our money is made from basically Memorial Day to Labor Day, 75% of our business. Typically, you're on a two-hour wait all day long. You're extremely busy. Right now, you can walk in the restaurant and see empty tables.
Well, Matt Chip, I feel I should play devil's advocate a bit here. You know, BP might say, look, there's going to be a lot of fraud. There's going to be a lot of suddenly people, you know, setting up lemonade stands and, you know,
right,
claiming lost revenue, and they have to be careful.
Well, I understand that, but when you supply them tax records and tax deposit records, and you supply them very detailed information, extremely legitimate for the losses, that's when the problem comes. They still are giving us the runaround when everything we've supplied has been backed up by tax records and information that is credible.
Do you think that the panel, that like the one the president is proposing, an independent panel with a fund set up by BP, do you think that that will be better?
It'll be somewhat better if it's run more efficiently. If you're going to continue to have the red tape and continue to have to jump through hoops in order to get your claim, no. But can it be done efficiently? Possibly. It's got to be more efficient than BP's doing now.
Matt Shipps, again of Shipps Harbor Grill. We understand you just moved there in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
You've got two girls in school.
Correct.
Are you scared?
Extremely. You know, I tell my daughter's 10, and she came to me the other day and says, Daddy, I don't want to move. You know, it's kind of hard to tell your 10-year-old you don't know what's going to happen. You pick up her life at age 9, and you move her to a new place. She's extremely happy, has new friends, and now what do you do? My 3-year-old wakes up and says, hey, Daddy, let's go look at the oil today. That's, you know, pretty strong stuff for a 10- to 3-year-old to say to you. So, yeah, we're scared because if we don't make it in the summer and BP doesn't pay compensations, we won't be here through the fall.
That's Matt Shipp of Shipps Harbor Grill in Orange Beach, Alabama. Matt, best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, just ahead, Gulf businesses make the case to lift the moratorium on deep-sea water drilling. They say thousands of jobs in the Gulf depend on those rigs, and many of America's pensions are directly tied to one company. Also later today, how Debate Club helped one high schooler find his inner Alex P. Keaton. Remember the Michael J. Fox character? That's later. But we'll have more from the Gulf in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. If you've just joined us, executives from the Big Five oil companies are testifying before Congress today. Four of those companies have been trying to distance themselves from the fifth, BP, but also trying to make the case that the president should lift the moratorium he placed last month on deepwater drilling, suspending 33 operations in the Gulf. Now, that may seem inconceivable to lift a ban after such a disaster, but the businesses that support those big rigs have been devastated. Otto Candy's Marine Transportation and Towing is one of those companies. Otto Candy's III joins us. And Otto, first of all, tell us about the work your company does.
We are in the business of supplying the boats that bring the people and the supplies out to the rigs, and also do inspections and also relocate the rigs.
How many people work for you doing this?
We have about 500 employees.
And how is the moratorium on drilling affecting you?
We're already starting to see rigs shutting down and leaving the area. And what you're going to have there is an effect where all of the jobs that go with, for example, our company, the boats, but also all of these support functions like mechanics and caterers and divers, et cetera, those jobs will leave this area.
Well, and we remind ourselves, these rigs are not static. The one that was involved in the BP blowout was just doing an exploratory well. In fact, they were in a hurry to move on to do something else. These rigs travel. So you're saying when they cost maybe, what, $500,000 a day to be leased, they're going to move on.
That's absolutely right. I mean, that type of equipment will not sit for 6 months and generate nothing. So the other likely areas for them to go to work would be places like West Africa or Brazil.
And outside of your business, you've told us a little bit about what you do. What other businesses do you see affected by rigs leaving that we may not think about?
We did a recent survey of a trade organization that we have, and our members had approximately 11,000 vendor companies that do support work for us, from supplying everything from food to paint to repairs to whatever you can think of, and then probably a whole lot more that you wouldn't think of.
11,000 companies.
That's right.
But Otto, you know, you and others therefore want the moratorium lifted, but can you see how some people might be appalled at that? We're hearing about emails showing that BP knew this well was, quote, a nightmare, that corners were cut, that the federal agency in charge of oversight was beyond lax, that the companies haven't done anything to update cleaning technologies. You know, the list goes on and on and on, and Americans are hesitant.
Look, certainly nobody here in the industry is downplaying what happened here. It's a terrible catastrophe. I mean, I'm a native Louisianian. I've lived here my entire life, so I hate to see what's happening to our environment. But if you really look historically, it's a very safe industry. This is a terrible accident. I've heard the analogy used a couple of times. It would be akin to, you know, one plane crash grounding basically an entire industry. And what we're saying to the government is, if you need to do inspections, if you need to ensure safety, do it. Let's go ahead and get it done. But let's just not do a blanket moratorium that's going to affect not only the immediate jobs that you're thinking of, but also the economy of an entire region. And then what you do really is you take an already terrible ecological and environmental disaster, and you make the economic portion of it even that much greater.
Otto Candies III of Otto Candies Marine Transportation and Towing, speaking to us from, where are you, Otto, in Louisiana?
I'm in Des Alamans, Louisiana, which is near New Orleans.
Otto, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Let's turn to Shane Guidry, Chair and Chief Executive of Harvey Gulf International Marine in New Orleans, who also services the rigs. And Shane, I understand you know Otto Candies well. And we just heard Otto say that one of the big concerns he has is that the rigs are up and leaving behind jobs. But you have another concern about the impact of the moratorium on rigs.
Yeah, what happens here, it stretches even further. You know, take my company, for instance. I was bought by a group in New York that manages pension fund money. They manage Houston firefighters. They manage $250 million from the Canadian Social Security Administration.
You're still the CEO of the company, but as you said, you sold your business for quite a bit, $500 million 18 months ago. And some would say you could sail off into the sunset, but you still have concerns because, as you said, the people who bought your company manage pensions. What does that mean to you?
People who depend on investment groups like the guys that purchased my company, they depend on a return. They depend on that return for their retirement. So what happens with this moratorium is as the rigs leave and the people lose their jobs and it takes 2 years to come back, these people's retirement lives are affected. The Ireland Social Security Administration has some funds in here, as well as Canadian Social Security Administration, Houston firefighters, teachers' pension funds throughout America.
So we hear what you're saying, but again, playing devil's advocate and asking the same thing we asked Otto, we're hearing a list of the incompetency of BP, but also the federal agency that was to provide oversight in the Gulf, you know, down to BP's plan for failure in the Gulf listed protecting walruses. There are no walruses in the Gulf. You know, with this kind of concern, Americans may be hesitant to start up deep sea drilling again.
You know, I would have to agree with you that the government let us down. All the more reason that the government should have nationalized this oil spill. They threw $1 trillion at the banks. They threw billions of dollars to the auto industry to save them. We need this industry. We need this energy independence.
Well, you're
they haven't thrown a single dollar at this yet.
Well, you're saying that the president should have done that in the past. In the last few weeks, Obama administration said they did not want to nationalize it because then they would have taken on the cost of it. Going forward, the president is forcing BP to open up a fund, have an independent panel, and is talking about being willing to take over the company. What else do you need to hear from President Obama when he speaks tonight?
Okay, he can't force BP to do anything. He can ask and negotiate, but at the end of the day, if they tell him no, that's going to be a legal battle. It'll take forever. Like I said, nationalize this thing, and you go after BP. You go after reserves in the ground. You go after their assets here in America if need be.
What you're saying is you want more government involvement. I mean, before the BP spill, we heard words like nationalize. We were hearing Obama being called a socialist. But you're saying this is what you want, more government.
Nationalize this thing for the American people and the people who are suffering economic loss and jobs.
That's Shane Guidry, Chair and Chief Executive of Harvey Gulf International Marine. Shane, thanks so much for your input.
Thank you for having me.
And by the way, I said the president was talking about taking over the company. I meant the claims payout that we've been hearing about. But we want to hear your thoughts. We'd love to hear them. Go to hearandnow.org, click on Contact Us to send an email, or scroll down and leave a comment right there on the homepage, hearandnow.org. Let us hear from you. Latest news is next, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. British Prime Minister David Cameron apologized today for the 1972 killing of 14 Catholic demonstrators by British troops in Northern Ireland, the day that became known as Bloody Sunday. He said some soldiers' actions that day were unjustified, but didn't say whether they should be prosecuted. And his comments followed the release of the government's long-awaited report on Bloody Sunday, one of the worst incidents during the Troubles, the conflict between Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland.
Politically motivated violence was never justified, whichever side it came from. And it can never be justified by those criminal gangs that today want to drag Northern Ireland back to its bitter and bloody past.
British Prime Minister David Cameron in Parliament today. Well, turning from the divisions in Northern Ireland to the ethnic fighting in Kyrgyzstan, the International Red Cross estimates several hundred people have been killed during several days of rioting there. The fighting involves the Kyrgyz and Uzbek people. Tensions have been high in Kyrgyzstan since the country's president, who is supported by the Kyrgyz, was ousted this past spring. The Uzbeks support the interim government that took over in April. The BBC's Rupert Wingfield Hayes prepared this report.
Stay behind me, Nuzimbek calls out. He's worried there are still snipers around.
Here is the jewelry bazaar market.
This was the jewelry bazaar?
Yeah.
It's now completely deserted. There's no one here at all. Where's everybody gone?
They went to the Uzbek border.
Right, so they've fled to Uzbekistan.
Yeah.
I'm in what was, until last week, the old Uzbek market in the middle of Osh. A few days ago, this place would have been teeming with hundreds, maybe thousands of people. Now it's a burned-out shell, destroyed in 4 days of ethnic bloodletting. Nuzimbek says it started last Thursday night, when a large group of ethnic Kyrgyz men entered the neighborhood and began setting fire to Uzbek-owned homes.
Have you any idea why? Why did this start?
It's war between Uzbeks and Kyrgyz. It was 20 years ago, and now it's repeat. They just want us dead, killed. Kyrgyz, they want to kill Uzbeks.
A short distance further on, we enter Lenin Street.
We're just walking into the neighborhood. There is a big two-story shop on the right-hand side, completely destroyed and burned out. All the buildings on either side of the street here, big houses with courtyards, with walls around, all completely destroyed. Some of them still smoldering 2 or 3 days after the fighting happened here.
As I stand and watch, flames start to leap from the roof of another house. Soon it's engulfed, the tiles on its roof cracking in the heat. Across the street, married John is picking through the rubble of his ruined home. When the shooting began, he scrambled over the wall into his neighbour's house. But others were not so lucky.
They stabbed my neighbor's brother. Then they cut the throat of his disabled son, dragged him out on the street, and set fire to him.
It's impossible for us to independently verify exactly what happened here, But everybody we've spoken to in this neighborhood has told us exactly the same story, that the attacks here were not some spontaneous orgy of violence, but that they were carefully planned and led by men in uniforms.
With curfew fast approaching, we managed to cross the no-man's land into the Kyrgyz-controlled side of the city. There are more burned-out streets and overturned cars. A lone armoured car and a few scruffy soldiers are the only sign of government control here. In fact, the Kyrgyz government is still not in control of Osh, not by a long way. On a street corner, I'm approached by Azamat Arabayev. He says the only answer now is to bring back Kyrgyzstan's old Soviet masters.
Most people here really want the Russians to come and help. Russia must send troops.
But the Kremlin is in no hurry to intervene, and nor is anyone else. For now, the people of Kyrgyzstan are on their own.
That report from the BBC's Rupert Wingfold Hayes in Kyrgyzstan. When we come back, a glimpse into what those FBI files on Ted Kennedy showed. That's in 30 seconds, here and now. Welcome back. So many people tried to download the FBI's release of thousands of documents on the late Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy that the site temporarily shut down yesterday. Here's a glimpse of what those papers contain. Most compelling, the constant stream of death threats. Some people threatened to shoot Ted Kennedy, one threatened to use a crossbow. Even Robert Kennedy's assassin, Sirhan Sirhan, threatened Ted Kennedy's life. From his jail cell, he offered $1 million in a car to anyone who would kill the senator. Historian Doris Kearns Goodwin looked over the documents. She was surprised by the extent of the death threats, but also says he made a choice to pursue his ambitions anyway.
I remember in 1980 when we were talking with him about the question of whether he would run for the presidency, and he noted to us that his children were concerned about whether or not there'd be an attack on him as there had been on his brothers. But he just said at a certain point, you have to decide, almost by a matter of will, that you will not allow yourself to be afraid.
In his memoir, True Compass, published after his death, Ted Kennedy wrote about being startled by sudden noises. I flinch at 21-gun salutes at Arlington to honor the fallen in Iraq. My reaction is subconscious. I know I'm not in danger, but it still cuts through me. We might have known about these death threats. Some expressed anger that Ted Kennedy didn't serve time for the 1969 Chappaquiddick accident. Senator Kennedy, you'll remember, was driving the car. His passenger, Mary Jo Kopechne, drowned. Kennedy pled guilty to leaving the scene of an accident where someone was hurt. He only got probation and a suspended sentence. Chappaquiddick came up in the documents, mostly in newspaper clippings, but Kennedy biographer Adam Clymer was impressed by one document that wasn't directly from the news. It was a cable from local police to the FBI under then-director J. Edgar Hoover.
There is one document that is not a newspaper clip, and that's an early heads-up from Dominic Arena, the police chief, to Hoover, saying that this Miss Poharsky, he got the name wrong, or the agent who took the message down got it wrong. It's been killed in a car, and Ted Kennedy was the driver, but that's being kept secret right now.
The documents also reveal more about the relationship between the Kennedy family and Hoover. For instance, we learn about an urgent FBI communication under Hoover's name. It's from the day in 1968 that Robert Kennedy died. It says, please make sure that Ted Kennedy gets all the protection he needs. We're now down to one Kennedy. When he was young, journalist and author Mark Oppenheimer was annoying. He talked too much.
I felt this constraint keenly. I even think that if asked, I could have described what I was feeling, that someday I could be a fine wordsmith, but for the time being, I just had all these words and no place to take them. So I did what millions of boys before me, and girls too, but not as frequently as boys, had done. I began to think of myself around fourth grade as a master of words. I became a wise ass. Or maybe I was a smart aleck, or even a Weisenheimer.
Weisenheimer is the name of Mark's new memoir. It tells of a painful childhood in which he alternately was picked on and became a secret bully, pulling dangerous pranks to make himself feel better. But it lands on the discovery of the debate club. Mark is well aware that many people view debaters as losers, but to him it was a place where he could shine. Mark Oppenheimer joins us from the Christian Science Monitor studios in Washington, D.C. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, let's start at the beginning. You came from a very progressive family for whom words mattered, but even they couldn't take it. You remember one time when your mom was on the phone?
My mother would, when I was 3 or 4 years old, she would call my father, who taught at a small law school in western Massachusetts. He got out of class at 3 o'clock or so, and she'd say, please, Tim, could you come home? Mark just won't stop talking at me. You have to come rescue me.
You got in fights with a family friend, Hank, over things like Ronald Reagan's views of affirmative action.
I would just sort of saunter up to him and I would say, well, Hank, I hear you talking about how important affirmative action is, but couldn't affirmative action be seen as a kind of discrimination? This would be when I was, 7 years old. And he was very condescending. He would say, well, maybe you wouldn't be saying that if you'd been alive 30 years ago and seen what people had to fight through. And I would say, well, Hank, I think that's really a logical fallacy. That's the ad hominem fallacy. You're attacking the person rather than the argument. Let's not talk about me and what I lived through, Hank. Let's just talk about the merits of your argument. You would get very hot under the collar.
But how painful was that when you were in school?
Well, I was an odd kid. And one of the things that I really argue is that American society is very, very good at creating constructive, challenging activities for young children who are precocious in math or in science, but we're not very good at figuring out what to do with our kids who are precocious talkers. Adults and fellow students are often intimidated by it. They're often thrown off by it. They often think of it as, why don't you just talk like the rest of us? What are you trying to prove? Why are you being so uppity?
Well, at least you had Alex Keaton in Family Ties and at least 3 characters from Matthew Broderick, sort of nerds on film.
I was obsessed with the Alex P. Keaton character on Family Ties.
Alex, I asked you this morning to take the garbage out before you went to school.
Yeah, listen, Mom, I've been thinking. I have been taking out the garbage for many years now, and I think I've gotten all I can out of the experience.
I loved Ferris Bueller and some other Matthew Broderick characters. There was a great show starring Jason Bateman called It's Your Move, where he played this kind of smooth-talking, glib, practical jokester. And seeing these characters on television made me feel better about myself because I saw myself in them.
Yeah, but then that became a problem because it's one thing when you started bringing a briefcase to school, like some of these characters did, but it's quite another when you started imitating a character in It's Your Move. You started pulling pranks, and you write, you could call some of these things youthful mischief, but you knew that you were actually becoming a bully in a funny way because you wanted to get back at people.
It's a long story, but suffice it to say that I ended up calling one of those child abuse hotlines that you could read so much about on milk cartons in the mid-80s. Remember, there are always those missing children on milk cartons. I called a hotline, and I pretended to be a young girl whom I knew from school, and I said some awful things about her father having been sexually abusive. And as it turned out, they figured out where this girl lived, and police ended up going out to her house to question her father. And then the police figured out that I had made the calls, and they came to my school and yanked me out and were going to arrest me.
But, you are a terrific kid. It gives us insight into, you kind of like Kelly. It's just that she broke up with your friend Derek, and you're all 11,
right,
that this could lead to something with such consequences. Really, I'm glad you told the story because it tells us how that can happen.
I have carried with me ever since that time a deep fund of compassion for children who get in trouble and are maybe perceived to be juvenile delinquents. I was very, very lucky that I was a good student, that I was from a locally respected family, that I was white, that I was middle class. One of the things my father told me when this was all over and the police had declined to press charges, he looked me in the eyes and he said, if you were a black kid from the north end of Springfield, this would not go away so easily and it would really mark you for life and you're just damn lucky. And yeah. I've never forgotten that.
Well, and that, of course, was 20 years ago. Mark Oppenheimer, saved by his dad maybe, but also by the debate club, a place where he could put that overactive brain. We're going to hear more about that from Mark Oppenheimer, author of Weisenheimer, A Childhood Subject to Debate. That's in 1 minute here and now.
I want you to come by my house tonight, 7:30, corner of June and Campus.
How would I do that?
Holding tryouts for the debate team.
sure you want somebody like me?
No. That's why you're trying out.
A scene from The Great Debater is the 2007 film starring Denzel Washington as Professor Melvin Tolson, who took a debate team from an all-black college in Wiley, Texas, to the national championship in 1935. It was a way to get his students respect in the Jim Crow South. Well, journalist Mark Oppenheimer is white. He knows the stakes weren't quite as high, but he loved that film because debate helped him overcome being a social outcast and gave him opportunities he'd never dreamed of, like traveling to overseas competitions in which the star debaters were more popular than Harry Potter. It also helped him ultimately maybe change the minds of fellow American high school students who perceived debaters as losers. Mark writes about his experiences in his memoir, Weisenheimer, A Childhood Subject to Debate. And Mark Oppenheimer, take us into this world that you thrived in. You talk in the book about the fact that a movie like The Great Debaters doesn't really capture the artistry that you felt in debate. Why?
I was 12 years old when I first joined a debate team. I went to a junior high school that also was attached to an upper school, a high school. So I was 12 years old, and I was arguing every week against 17 and 18-year-old seniors from high school and holding my own. And for me, it felt like what I had read about in biographies of musicians or of Babe Ruth, when you read about the swing of the bat and the smack against the ball or the bow against the violin strings. It felt wonderful to be using words well. And I took tremendous pride in every part of it, not just using the proper vocabulary, but also things like ending on time. You know, when you're given 6 or 8 minutes to make your first speech, it's very impressive to the judges if you can wrap up the speech in 7 minutes, 58 seconds. And being able to time things that well, and also being able to conclude with what's called a peroration, the sort of summing up at the end, being able to pace the speech so that it reached a climax just before the 8 minutes was up. I mean, it really seemed to me a kind of artistry. And I was a boy who wasn't gifted in things like sports or music, so this was my instrument.
Yeah. Take us a little bit into this world. It's rarefied air for many. A lot of people didn't go into debate, but the way you write about it, it makes you want to do it. Take us into the structure of the debate world. Two big national organizations, two styles here in the U.S. Explain that.
The American scholastic debate world is divided into a couple leagues. There's the National Forensic League and also the National Catholic Forensic League. There are also assorted regional leagues. I debated in one called the Debate Association of New England Independent Schools. But more interestingly, there are a variety of styles. So within the National Forensic League, you can do policy debate, which is very rapid fire. People talk as fast as they can to make as many points as they can. There's also Lincoln-Douglas debate, named after Abraham Lincoln and Stephen Douglas. And that's one-on-one, and it tends to be less evidence-oriented, but more about philosophical discussion. But the National Forensic League has these wonderful categories like humorous interpretive reading or extemporaneous speaking or duo interp, where two people have to perform a monologue in tandem, speaking back and forth. So some of it veers into drama, some of it veers into philosophy, some of it is kind of pure, straightforward political oratory. So there's something for all sorts of kids. Anyone who likes to talk will find something in the world of debate. It's also just a great scene. I mean, you go to these tournaments on Saturdays or Sundays, and you have all these 15 and 16-year-olds decked out in their suits, and the young ladies are in their pantsuits or their skirts and pumps, and everyone, the shoes are shined, and the boys have their ties on, and some of the foppish kids are wearing bow ties, and they have briefcases, and they have filing cabinets. It's just a whole subculture unto itself, a world in which the really talkative, glib, nerdy kid is the king or queen.
Finally, you could dress like Alex Keaton.
Oh, it was wonderful. I loved it. My parents took me to Saks Fifth Avenue in New York to the boys' department, and I had this wonderful double-breasted suit, and I would wear it with one of those mid-80s yellow power ties, yellow with like black dots on it, and I just felt like the emperor with his clothes.
Well, and one of the forms of debate, policy debate, was the one that you used largely early on, a variant of the Oregon style?
What distinguishes it, you debate on a prepared topic. So, for example, this was when Ronald Reagan was pushing for more funding for the Strategic Defense Initiative, or Star Wars. That was our topic my seventh grade year. You prepare in advance. You debate the same topic all year. It's two against two on each side. So each team comes in with two people who then take turns. And in the Oregon style, there's cross-examination. So it feels very much like a courtroom. And debates could very much be won or lost based on, did you manage to break the other side during cross-ex, or were you yourself broken? And so it was very, very tense and very exciting.
You know what I want to do? Because this is what was so fascinating, because you became a journalist, as we said, But here in debate, you learn to take both sides because you didn't know if you were going to be assigned the affirmative or the negative, the person who was for or against an issue. So you had to be as passionate and as informed about either side, issues like abortion, the death penalty, just war theory, as you said, Star Wars. Pick an issue now and just quickly be on one side and then the other.
All right. Well, let's look at something like the regulatory bill that's before the Congress. I mean, if you're going to take the pro side and talk about regulating the banks, you might have 3 points in favor of that. Number one, you might have a historical point. You might say historically, when banks are deregulated, you have huge problems. There was a massive buildup of regulation after the Great Depression. Then in recent years, under conservative administrations, we've eased off. We have to tighten the reins again. Second of all, you want to increase consumer confidence. When banks fail and when governments appear shaky, the people begin to lose faith in their governments. And so it's not just consumer confidence, but it's also the confidence of the citizenry and the confidence of politics. Third of all, you want to heighten people's feelings about Congress. You want them to be proactive and to do something. And one of the most hurtful things about the Republicans initially not allowing a vote to debate on the recent bill is that it gave the appearance that this was a do-nothing Congress, and that creates a malaise, as Jimmy Carter might have called it. But then on the opposite side, you might want to say, well, look, on the other hand, there's a very strong argument made by libertarian economists, certainly if you go read someone like Thomas Sowell, that will say that the problem is always too much regulation. It's not that you don't have enough. It's that we've been over-regulated for close to a century, and if you really want markets to operate and banks to operate well, you have to back off and just allow people's freedom of information to help them make informed choices. Second of all, you could say that largely we've reined things in, that the stimulus bill has worked, and that there's no need to do anymore. So it's only these overly aggressive, pseudo-progressive Democrats who are trying to go in and thwart capitalism. This is socialism in disguise, and we shouldn't do it. And third of all, you might say that an overly active Congress is exactly the problem, that as conservatives have said for years, sometimes you just need to stand aside history and yell stop. That was what William F. Buckley said on founding National Review, that conservatives just have to say stop. Sometimes doing nothing is better than doing something. And so for all those reasons, you might oppose the resolution.
Bing, time's up, Mr. Oppenheimer. Well, is this how you then approach life now? Because you say that when you first went into debate, you could feel your mind stretching, that it was your first experience with the power of art, that a speech in a round of debate is an 8-minute aria if it goes well. Is this now a lifelong skill for you?
I do hope that in conversations and in my journalism that I try to see both sides of the issue. We always tried to be guided by Cicero's dictum that you should always state your opponent's case in the strongest possible terms. I mean, that was something that Mr. Robison, my high school coach, believed very strongly, that you don't ridicule your opponent, that you try to honor your opponent and state his or her case strongly before stating why you disagree. So I hope that more than anything in my journalism, I really do try to honor both sides of an issue. I will confess that in my personal life, I'm still pretty argumentative. You know, I'm not sure that my wife would say I'm always the best at seeing both sides of the issue. But certainly in my professional life, I see writing as very much a search for the truth, not just a chance to win.
Mark Oppenheimer, his book is Weisenheimer, A Childhood Subject to Debate. Mark, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.